on astroturfing and you really find out what's going on. And we are going to talk about this topic with Matthew Arrett as well right now before that. Good morning, Matthew. Ich weiß, du hast...
Well, it's in the wee hours of the morning, so here in Montreal it's 5 o'clock, and I'll try my best to be as cogent as humanly possible. I'm not used to waking up this early, but I'll hopefully not put your viewers to sleep. I know that we had discussed the idea of astroturfing, and I will briefly touch upon that a little bit indirectly, but that won't be necessarily the focus of my brief presentation today. And since we began a little bit late, let me just quickly ask, will I be speaking for 60 minutes, or should I cut it down to 50?
No, don't. Do take your time and tell it like it is. Don't take any unnecessary precautions. I know that viewers are really happy that you're with us, and everybody wants to hear what you have to say, unabridged.
Okay. All right, unabridged. So I think that the... well, I'll do a little bit of a screen share here before I proceed. Here we are. So I arranged a few thoughts today because we are on the verge of a major conference, which is being heralded as the most important conference for climate change in the world. That will be a 2-week-long event with 25,000 delegates coming to the UK, to Scotland, essentially to attempt... and I don't think this is going to work, but to attempt to essentially reset society and create the foundations for a new set of values, which is supposedly going to be brought online, perhaps after a period of chaos, whereby the new set of values that will emerge, we are told, will be drastically different from anything that we have ever known in the age of abundance that is long gone, they say. And we're constantly being told that we have to prepare for a new age of scarcity, of living with less, and just tightening our belts. Meanwhile, but not for everybody, there are some who, as we've seen from the golden collar class who frequent Davos, that some will supposedly be the owners of the things that everyone else will have the privilege of renting from, or provided their behavior is acceptable to the new standards. We are today going through a profound shift. That is very true. We are at the end of a system which we could see now is going through turbulence. The banking system is in a situation where it's basically not a banking system anymore in the West. We have become one big speculative bubble. Most of it is fictitious capital. And we discussed this in my last opportunity to speak to your audience. The underlying debt, which is sustaining these bubbles, this fictitious capital, is itself chimerical. It will never be paid. It cannot be paid. It is waiting for a chain reaction set of defaults. the thing which is most important amongst all of this, which I want to go through in the course of three sections in this short presentation, will be the quality of ideas that has brought us to the crisis. Because human beings, and this is, I'm going to say this now and I'm going to say this at the end, the nature of human beings, what are we? This is what everything boils down to in terms of trying to understand geopolitics, history, trying to problem solve or see the pathways out of a storm. You have to realize that everything boils down to the nature of human beings. And are we a creature whose species character is defined by material circumstances, genetic, our environment, for example, or material things? Is that really what limits us as a human species? Because that is certainly what limits most other species that we know of in the biosphere. Or do we have something additional on top of those material conditions? Do we have a set of metaphysical things known as ideas that are right or wrong, and free will to abide by good ideas and reject bad ideas? Because if we tolerate bad ideas for too long, there are consequences that must be paid. And if that means a system collapses, then we should have learned while we had time. And I think we still do have time. So what are some of the bad ideas? I'm going to go through this, like I said, in three sections. The first part will be a brief overview of some of the recent political strategic circumstances of our age. The second will be some historical backdrop, featuring an insight into the governing ideas going back from the 1940s until the present. And then we're going to look at some science, specifically what has been kept from us as far as scientific method is concerned in the recent several decades, as a poor element on the periodic table has been very much demonized, and and that element is, or that molecule is, carbon dioxide, which is not a pollutant. It's not a dangerous thing, and it is very, very similar to the problems of people who believe in COVID-19 as the cause of the great upcoming supposed pandemic that could destroy everybody unless we radically modify our global behavior. So, just to begin, a quote that caught me from a book from 1956, How to Lie with Statistics, is quite good. A well-wrapped statistic is better than Hitler's big lie. It misleads, yet it cannot be pinned on you. This is a very important lesson to keep in mind in this book, How to Lie with Statistics. Keep in mind is also amongst one of Bill Gates's favorite books that he has put on his recommended reading list. What is COP26? So as I said, this is something that will begin very shortly until November 12th. And the aims of it are very simple. It is being governed by a fellow Canadian. I'm very sorry that we've presented him to the world, from Canada, named Mark Carney, who has been held responsible for managing much of this. He's a high-level technocrat, as many people know, an investment banker from Goldman Sachs who rose to become the governor of the Bank of Canada for a period, and then the governor of the Bank of England, as well as the head of the Financial Stability Board right after Mario Draghi had filled the post, where he regulated and managed international derivatives. He managed the implementation of a global bail-in regime to prepare for stealing people or confiscating people's savings under the conditions of an economic meltdown. And he's now been in charge of managing COP26. So what are the objectives and aims of COP26? I've alluded to it already, but essentially, in short form, lower the CO2 emissions to net zero by 2050, supposedly to keep temperatures 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. All right, that's what they're saying. That's what they want to do, supposedly because those temperature changes are tied to carbon dioxide made by human beings. That's the assertion. We're going to evaluate whether that's true or not very shortly. CO2 reduction targets from every nation have to be made legally binding and enforceable by new global bodies that have to be brought online that have more power than sovereign nation states. The creation of a global carbon market, which is what Carney has been spearheading for a number of years now, which is Article 6 of the Paris Accords, that never really went through because many nations, you know, they realize that if they go along with this, they're going to be sacrificed and there will be mass death. So this has been something that has faced a lot of resistance, and as well a vastly expanded set of conservation areas of the world. The Congo River Basin area is a major one, and the idea is to expand what already exists to make areas completely impossible to develop with hydroelectric dams or water management systems or anything that disturbs the supposedly mathematical equilibrium, the homeostasis of ecosystems, which computer models that we use demand exist. Now, that might not necessarily be true. There might not be any such homeostasis that actually exists, even though the computer models that think for us all demand it, because that's what computer models, they're fundamentally based upon certain binary mathematical systems of equations that are all premised upon balance. You don't seem to see that in the physical space-time of nature, where evolution of life is constantly changing and moving in a very dynamic way. Additionally, Carney wants to get $135 trillion of investment into renewable energy, wind and solar, primarily over 30 years. One of the things that Carney has said recently, in 2019, was a major banking conference where he said that climate disclosures must become comprehensive, climate risk management must be transformed, and sustainable investment must go mainstream. He then took on a more threatening tone, saying the firms that anticipate these developments will be rewarded handsomely. Those that don't will cease to exist. other bankers at this similar conference where he spoke included people like Larry Fink and others from BlackRock, who had called for a financial regime change. This is right before COVID was sprung onto the world. The idea of, and what Carney has been really pushing with many of these financiers from JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Deutsche Bank, many of the banks that are part of the Green Climate Compact, which is essentially an agreement that we will no longer, as bankers, fund or provide loans to dirty companies that create CO2. And that also includes specifically a targeting of Africa and the developing sector that desperately needs to use the coal and other oil and resources under their soil for their development to end hunger and end poverty. But they're being told that they're not going to be allowed because the greater threat is against nature. And if you develop your people, it means you're going to hurt nature. So we have to withhold funding or at least punish you by imposing prohibitively large interest rates on loans that you will make things very financially impossible to develop. So to go back in time a little bit here, I want to just pick up where we left off in a previous segment, which dealt with the role of things like the Rockefeller Foundation, the Macy Foundation, the British Eugenics Society in spreading and sponsoring a science of eugenics from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, as well as the banks and others that that funded these organizations that also funded fascism as a political economy designed to enforce this new type of science of population control, which fortunately was put down when Hitler was defeated. But keep in mind from, as we've discussed prior, these eugenics laws, the idea of defining human beings kind of like you would define horses or other forms of cattle monetarily, as well as based upon the idea of selective breeding, euthanizing or sterilizing the unfit, was all based upon a certain type of extrapolation of trends. You take statistical data sets of somebody's family, you extrapolate your grandparents, great-grandparents who tended to maybe have a low IQ, ignore their economic circumstances for the minute, and just extrapolate the trends into the future as your children, great-grandchildren that don't even exist yet are presumed to most likely be also fated with low IQ or criminality or whatever other variable you're looking at as a eugenicist. And based upon those statistical probabilities, one will justify the sterilization of people or euthanizing of people. This was done in all over the United States. It was done across Europe and Britain. It was especially done in Germany, as we know. But those who promoted Hitler, who promoted eugenics, were never punished in Nuremberg. And one of the key figures who plays a very big role in the growth, the cancerous growth of this terrible set of ideas that shaped so much of our past 70 years, is a figure named Sir Julian Huxley. Julian Huxley was the founder and first director general of UNESCO, the United Nations Education, Science, and Cultural Organization. I'm going to say a few things about this trajectory of ideas because it plays right back to understanding where does COP26 come from? Where does this false set of ideas come from that justify us essentially human beings as something which is overpopulated, that we have to manage or reduce the impact of human beings on the earth by reducing or putting values on carbon footprint reduction. So rather than putting economic behavior and practice on increasing productivity as it once was the case years ago, instead, Carney and others of this Davos clique group who are managing the Great Reset, they want to put the new set of values on how much you can reduce the means of sustaining human life. The more you can reduce human life, the more money you can make. This is a completely absurd and unscientific and immoral, most important set of ideas. But again, it gets its origins in this moment. So in the UNESCO manifesto, its purpose and philosophy, which people can read online, I picked two quotes. One is the first one, where Julian, who, keep in mind, is also a eugenicist, says that political unification in some sort of world government will be required, even though any radical eugenic policy will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible. It will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake so that much that is now unthinkable may at least become thinkable. In short, Hitler made eugenics look very bad for the world, and he set our plans back. So how do we repackage eugenics under a new veneer, a new costume, so that people who cannot possibly think of doing eugenics anymore, which he says is the queen of all sciences, the thing that must guide every other scientific policy is eugenics, the science of control of people. How do we repackage that to make it become thinkable, make it acceptable? In another quote in that same document, he says clearly the moral for UNESCO is clear. The task laid upon it of promoting peace and security can never be wholly realized through the means assigned to it, education, science, and culture. It must envision some form of world political unity, whether through a single world government or otherwise, as the only certain means of avoiding war. In its educational program, it can stress the ultimate need for a world political unity and familiarize all people with the implications of the transfer of full sovereignty from separate nations to a world organization. This is directly at the manifesto of UNESCO, which went on to have a profound impact on shaping global cultural policy, especially amongst the West, as well as educational policy, along with the OECD in the 1950s throughout the Cold War. Very important concepts, because this, again, these ideas that are metaphysical, shaped not for the better, but for the worse, are potential as a species. So what clues do we have for how the thinkable became thinkable in Huxley's mind? What did he do? Well, to investigate this, we can make a point that he did found UNESCO, and I made that point. He was also the head of the Union for the Conservation of Nature, which was the world's first environmental conservation movement in 1947. Sorry, it's going a little slow. He co-founds a new study, a new philosophy called transhumanism, along with Pierre-Teilhard de Chardin, the so-called priest, based on an idea of merging human beings with machinery and other things at some imaginary singularity, or as Chardin says, omega point in the future, whereby the masterclass, the Ubermenschen, will take control of the means of natural selection and a new species will be created. This is, I think, very inspired by the work of his brother, Aldous Huxley, in Brave New World. People like Ray Kurzweil, the Google lead engineer, is a big fan of this and carried this forward in the form of his singularity theory, as is Yuval Harari, the other World Economic Forum thinker. He was also the president of the British Eugenic Society from 1958 to 1962, and its vice president earlier, at the same time that he created the World Wildlife Fund for Nature with Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Bernhard had just recently created the Bilderberger Group in 1955 to coordinate, essentially, as Huxley pointed out, the dissolution of nation states and the creation of new global structures of control that essentially reinstated the powers of the British Empire under a new mutated form. And keep in mind as well, the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, this seems like a nice thing on the surface. Of course, we want a pure world. We want a clean world. We don't want pollution in our oceans. Of course, that's true. But what this organization did, you got to keep in mind, what's happening is you have Enrico Mattei at this time. You got Dag Hammarskjöld, who's fighting imperialism. You've got leading statesmen like John F. Kennedy rising and fighting for the development of Africa and South America, along with people like Charles de Gaulle, who are working to develop large-scale infrastructure to liberate people so that every nation that was colonized can stand on its own two feet by developing large-scale infrastructure development and full-spectrum economics. That was the momentum of humanism, moral humanism, that was shaping the world. And the idea was formally that human beings had to be liberated from empire. And we would do that through the belief in scientific and technological progress that would allow us to overcome the limits to growth. And in that world, that old ethic that we've since seen dissipate badly over the last decades, the idea was that people are good. Babies are good. You don't want more babies just to have more babies. But you realize that every baby has a soul. Every baby has a potential mind to be developed if you give it the opportunity and the inspiration. And thus, every baby can be a Mozart, a Beethoven, a Max Planck, whatever, and make discoveries so that the limits of nature that are holding human beings back can always be transcended with new discoveries of principles of the universe. That is something that materialists, who are every imperialist or slave owner is effectively a materialist, they don't believe that because they're control freaks. They believe what exists now is all that can ever be, and that must be thus controlled to be used for dividing and conquering the weaker on the part of the stronger. So when they look at human growth, an imperialist doesn't see what I saw. They don't see that the purpose of nation states or science is to liberate people from want or starvation or the effects of empire. They rather saw, especially with the World Wildlife Fund and the transformation of the ethical base of society in the 60s, which obviously happened over the dead bodies of many great leaders, including Mattei of Italy, as well as Lumumba and JFK and Bobby Kennedy. But what they see is a cancer. So this is what many people see these days who have been cynically weaned off of our modern education system and you know, movies that paint human beings in a very cynical, parasitical way, very corrupt way. So they see population growth, and they just see a quantity of cells of a cancer growing over Gaia, destroying nature. This is unhealthy, because underlying this quantitative growth, we have also qualities. The ability to live a longer life is attained as well. You know, our average life expectancy is very different today than it was 100 years ago or 500 years ago. So the ability, the quality of life is also being changed here, as well as quantity, when you're applying the fruits of thought, of good ideas, into the social organization of that system. This is, again, what people who became very famous in the 1960s, like Paul Ehrlich, a very influential zoologist, biologist, wrote a book called The Population Bomb, which made him a celebrity, where he said that a cancer is an uncontrolled multiplication of cells. The population explosion is an uncontrolled multiplication of people. We must shift our efforts from the treatment of the symptoms to the cutting out of the cancer. The operation will demand many apparently brutal and heartless decisions. This is cold-hearted. Basically, he is one of the many who were part of the movement that revived the theories of Malthus, Thomas Malthus, who we're going to see a little something about. But again, it's a good question. Are human beings just a cancer, right? How do you prove that that's truly wrong? There's a long quote. I had to pull it out. It's just so important. But it's one of Ehrlich's students, John Holdren, who co-wrote a book with Ehrlich called Eco-Science, Population, the Environment, in 1977. It's a big book. And in the book, there's a little problem here where something's blocking what I'm seeing.
One second, Matthew. Is that the same Paul Ehrlich whose name is now the one that describes our Paul Ehrlich Institute here in Germany? Or is that someone else?
I don't know. You know, there's a couple of Paul Ehrlichs, and I don't know about the one in Germany. I hope not.
It cannot be. It's older. Don't think.
Okay.
But there's his student, his prodigy, John Holdren, with Barack Obama. John Holdren was the United States science czar under Obama. And in this 1977 behemoth of a book, John Holdren writes...
It's not the same person. I just checked it.
No? Okay. Mm. All right. Perhaps those agencies, combined with UNEP, that's the United Nations Environmental Protection Agency, and the United Nations Population Agencies, which had just recently been controlled, this is me talking now, by Maurice Strong, might eventually be developed into a planetary regime, sort of an international super agency for population, resources, and environment. Such a comprehensive planetary regime could control the development, administration, conservation, and distribution of all natural resources, renewable or non-renewable, at least insofar as international implications exist. Thus, the regime could have the power to control pollution not only in the atmosphere and oceans, but also in such freshwater bodies as rivers and lakes that cross international boundaries or that discharge into oceans. The regime might also be a logical central agency for regulating all international trade, perhaps including assistance from developed countries to lower developed countries, and including all food on the international market. the planetary regime might be given responsibility for determining the optimum population for the world and for each region, and for arbitrating various countries' shares within their regional limits. Control of population size might remain the responsibility of each government, but the regime would have some power to enforce the agreed upon limits. And that is bone chilling, considering, again, the role and career of John Holdren, who, upon becoming science czar of the USA, wasted no time in advancing the green agenda in ways that were horrific, shutting down investments in nuclear science, nuclear fusion. The space program got some of its worst hits under Holdren, and things like Solyndra, the energy farm boondoggles, got massive government subsidies out of the wazoo. Science was really handicapped under this guy. And one of his closest friends is the current science czar named Eric Lander, who is a Rhodes Scholar in charge of formerly the Human Genome Project and is running U.S. science policy right now. So just keep that in mind, that this is a coterie of very, very sick minds, very misanthropic minds, who really, really are governed by a hate of something fundamental within the human condition. And I mentioned Malthus. Sorry, it's the slide is oh, there it is. So just quickly, the Neo-Malthusian revival, as it was called, was based upon the reactivation of an idea of Malthus, which was on the left here. That's the image of Malthus's mathematical theory of population, which became the governing science of the British East India Company for hundreds of years, and how they managed Ireland, India, Africa, everywhere, was the idea that population always grows faster than food and resources. And so you could always predict relatively a moment where the population will over exceed food production, and war, famine, other things will be the natural consequence. And thus the scientific rulers of the British Empire must always use this mathematical formula to control populations, to keep populations low. And Malthus even advises, killing babies to make room for new people, utilizing the gifts of famine, don't encourage hospitals for the poor, encourage wars if need be, to help do the things that nature wants to do anyway. It's absolutely sick. And I think that the experience of the 100 or 200 years after Malthus dies, or after he writes this book in 1799, demonstrates that he was wrong. He thought that the world population could go no higher than 1 billion. Holdren as well believed that it would cap off at the year 2000, where we'd go into complete collapse. Obviously, there's something else that they're not willing to look at within us that allows us to break their miserable predictions. This is the image from the Limits to Growth book from 1972, sponsored by the Club of Rome, which essentially, said, okay, now computer modeling, we could input a few variables, pollution, technology, we'll just call those variables, population, death, births, resources, and then just chart out, we'll make linear extrapolations and see where they all break down. And as you could see from the Limits to Growth predictions, it was the year 2000 once again, where deaths just massively increase, pollution grows. And of course, it makes no space whatsoever for creative discoveries. That doesn't exist because creative discoveries are non-linear. You cannot chart them in a binary one and zero computing machine. It can't work that way. The human mind is not limited to that, but they refuse to believe it. But that doesn't stop them from a Pygmalion effect. So once these Malthusians took control increasingly of Western nations, in the US, it took the form of the Trilateral Commission, people like Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, David Rockefeller, who were leaders of the Trilateral Commission that took over in the 1970s, made sure that their predictions of the computer models, that the reality conformed to the model, right? they didn't make their models conform to reality. They made reality conform to the models. So how did they do that? Well, if you look at the actual, for the low resolution, but if you look at the predicted pathways for fusion development, that's something which was predicted to be much, much more. We should have already had this for many years as a commercially viable process. It required that the scientists be given the means to build expensive prototypes to test their ideas. There's many different pathways to fusion. It's not just, you don't have to just put all your eggs in the ITER basket. That was all cut down so that nobody could build their designs and test them. And that was always known, that it was called the Fusion Never level of 1968. We're far below that today. And we've been below that since the 70s. another place, the highest point of per capita GDP as far as the percentage of the federal budget invested in space, which was once the driver of the entire economy, internet, GPS, cell phones, medical technologies, EKGs, so much of it came out of the drive for the space race as a crash program. That maximized, that the maximum moment was 1965, and every year since it's been cut down, even after we went to the moon. And by 1973, the Apollo missions were canceled, and the budget was kept under 1%, far under 1% for the next four decades. And all large-scale planning goals had all dwindled away, had all been shut down. We could look at any number of variables, including infrastructure investments collapsing, the outsourcing of industries, manufacturing that we need to have. If you're going to be a sovereign nation, you have to have industries. That was shut down. So, okay, why is this being done? One of the key culprits and that has been demonized in all of this process is carbon dioxide. And the whole house of cards crumbles. I remember, you know, Kerry Mulis, the person who invented the PCR test, had once made a point. He tried to find who was it who made the scientific study that proved that, and I'm not going to go on this in this presentation, but it was a good example, that proved that HIV virus that's found in many, many people causes AIDS. And he looked for the study, spent years looking for the, what was the study that made that connection? Because we were all shaping $100 billion industry around this assumption that this existed. And he realized that it didn't exist. Nobody ever made, it was just an asserted claim, but everyone had been acting as if that were true. And as a consequence, things like, reformed chemotherapy drugs were being given to people who were testing HIV positive, which were shutting down their immune system, and they were being kept on these former chemotherapy drugs for a very long time, which was itself, as all evidence seems to indicate, what was actually causing the death rates. That was what was causing the problem. It wasn't the actual HIV itself. And that continues to be a problem across Africa today. The same thing for COVID, right? If you're thinking, well, mm-hmm. we're told that there's this statistical correlation between this thing called COVID and these mass deaths that were being that were being pummeled with. 4 million people all died of COVID, and so these questionable data sets are being used and extrapolated into the future so that we modify our behavior and then take on therapies as a solution, which seem to actually be the things that are breaking down our immune system, potentially resulting in what could become another AIDS pandemic if this is actually true. That the gene therapies and other things are actually causing our immune systems to shut down, and how much worse is that going to get per booster shot? So back to CO2. If this is not tied to temperature, if there is no relationship between CO2 and temperature, the entire house of cards comes crumbling down. The entire basis for COP26 falls apart, because CO2, frankly, has been an integral part for the past 200 years of the industrial economy that we've been under, you know, that's a fact of life. So if you sustain life by industry, then if you tell people to get rid of industry, they won't do it. That will result in their children dying. The sleight of hand here has been find one of the contingent byproducts of industrial output, agro-industrial output, demonize that, and then people won't realize what's happening to them. Keep in mind as well, the U.S. itself has lost 17% of its residential electricity, its per capita electricity in only 10 years, 17%. And it's much worse in many other countries.
How did that happen?
That has been by just the shutdown of coal plants, mm-hmm. of other forms of more reliable forms of energy, natural gas plants and other things. Because mostly coal plants have been massively shut down in the U.S. And replaced with very unreliable wind and solar farms, which, I mean, oftentimes are just not very performative. They give you maybe 25% of their capacity. 25 to maybe 30% if you're lucky. But then when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow, as the case is in Britain right now, which is 25% reliant upon windmills, it fell down to less than 1% capacity. Very little storage and backup planning was made as well. So either this was just insanely incompetent or criminally, I wouldn't say criminally negligent. I would say criminal, yeah, as far as intentional.
I don't think there is any negligence in this.
No, I don't think so either. Mm-hmm. You have to try very hard to be this stupid. And I don't think these people there are a lot of stupid people, but I think the ones shaping this policy know exactly what the effects are, mm-hmm, of this perfect storm. That's even, we see this very much, especially in Europe, with the energy crisis today. So let me go through a few things here just to vindicate carbon dioxide, okay? Because I want people to really know this. The first thing, carbon dioxide, I was always told this is food for plants. And as NASA has recently observed, there has been, I think it's about a 10% increase in biomass on the Earth, largely due to the economic activities and planning of China and India, which account for the majority of this over the past 20 years. This is totally unexpected because everyone had thought that with industrial growth and population growth, there would only be a reduction of green matter on the Earth. That's the opposite. There's more photosynthetic activity, more chlorophyll. And it's largely because these countries are doing things very differently from us. They are building large-scale infrastructure. They are greening the Gobi Desert. They're moving the biggest water projects to move abundant water from the south of China, where there's a lot of floods, into the north, where there's a lot of drought, and greening deserts along the way, reclaiming deserts, and also producing a lot of industry, a lot of coal even, which I'm not a big fan of coal or things like that, or fossil fuels. However, it's not as evil as people think. And when you're poor and you want to get rid of poverty, this is a necessary pathway to go through. We went through it. Other countries should have the right to go through it as long as the objective is to get to more efficient forms of energy. So this is already greening the world as we speak. There's another graph of the greening function on the Earth. India, China, very much leading the charge. We here in the West have some areas that has seen increased greening in leaf area, but the difference is here it's because we've just stopped doing things, whereas there it's because they are doing things, and part of the effect of CO2 is feeding plants. This is an example of one of the many, many models of carbon dioxide emitters that you could buy as a farmer with a greenhouse. You have to buy a carbon dioxide machine to input carbon dioxide so that your food in your greenhouse grows better. This particular brand goes up to 1,500 parts per million, let's just say, in average on the Earth. It's about 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. So what they found is that when you input up to 1,500 parts per million, depending on the plant, you get faster growing, more nutrient, more nutritious, more vitamin rich, bigger, happier plants all the time. Vegetables, everything, fruits. It's again, food, right? And one other thing to keep in mind, this was what's being done in COP26 today. And I bring up China and India once more, because China and India, as well as Russia, Brazil, South Africa, have boycotted. The heads of state of those countries have all said recently they will not be going to COP26 because they don't want to be sacrificed on some altar of, you know, Gaia or anything like that. So they're just not going to go. And back in 2009, China and India also, their leaders boycotted in many ways COP14, which was the first attempt in 2009 to get a one world green government with binding carbon reduction protocols. And they basically locked themselves in a room, India and China and Sudan, and said, we're not going to participate. And it basically petered out. Nothing happened. They were given fuel because you had ClimateGate that emerged just weeks before that event occurred, which was a leak of thousands of emails from the East Anglia Climate Research Unit, where people like Phil Jones, who's still a very powerful figure, this unit was managing the climate models, things like the hockey stick chart that we're going to look at, that's used by the IPCC, the UN governments, that link CO2 with temperature. These emails prove that they were all covering up and fudging the data to keep the models active and ignore reality. So this created a scandal, and this gave the delegates at COP26 the opportunity to say, we're not going to participate. This is built on really shaky ground. Sorry. Many people think carbon dioxide is the majority of our greenhouse effect. It's actually not the most, the biggest greenhouse gas at all. The biggest one is water vapor. 95% of the greenhouse gases is water vapor from the oceans. The rest is, you know, things like methane, which is something like 0.3%, nitrous oxide, 0.9%, CO2, naturally occurring CO2 from plants and, you know, organic material that rots, or phytoplankton in the oceans, or volcanoes, which there's many volcanoes, many more than we even realize, 10 times more than we thought there were 15 years ago under the oceans. All of these things emit massive amounts of CO2. Of that 3.6%, which is already very negligible, human activity, human CO2 is less than 1%. It's about 0.9%. It is so negligible, it is ridiculous. But yet, this is what we're being told is causing all of the natural disasters, the tornadoes, the hurricanes, the earthquakes that we've never seen before. It's ridiculous.
How much was that again, of that 3.6%?
0.9%.
Huh. Less than 1%.
Approximately. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another graph that's useful, global CO2 emissions, right? The point that I think is most valuable is around 1850, where the Industrial Revolution is beginning to get into high gear. We're still burning mostly wood, but we're getting onto coal. And you could just see, country by country, the rate of growth of carbon dioxide approximately, the big countries and continents at least. And the US and the EU, as you know, we went into a consumer society post-industrial model under the Malthusian controllers of the 70s, we relatively sort of cap off from 1979 onward. But the other countries that want to develop and end hunger and poverty, they continue largely to grow their CO2. You would imagine that there would be a correlation in temperature that would follow according to this formula of CO2 causes temperature. That's not what we see. Similar graph, 1880 to the present period. What we see, in fact, from our temperature charts are a cooling period from 1880 until early 1900s, and then a warming period for about 30 years until 1942, and then a cooling period. It tapers off for about 35, 40 years until the 1977 period, and then we begin to see a warming period, and then it cools again. But this is a period. Why is it after World War II do we see now no more warming when we're at a maximum productivity level? We're putting out more CO2 than we ever had before. So why does the temperature not go along with that, right? These are very important questions. And then today, since the year 2000, the population has had 2.5 billion more people. Why did the temperature not continue to grow with the increased CO2 output globally? Why does it taper off?
So what has the development of the temperature been in the last 20 years since it's, or is this going until that's until the year 2020?
No, this is till the year 2014. So between the year 2000 and the year 2012 or 13, there was what's called the great, the global warming pause, which a lot of climatologists don't like looking at because it's embarrassing. They want to try to just ignore the data sets that showcase the pause. And now since then, we've seen an increased blip of warming in the past several years. But we've also seen so many anomalies like Antarctica. You know, the Antarctica is registering some of the coldest temperatures now on record. Its ice sheets are at the highest at this time of year on record. So we have many anomalies all over the place proving that these computer models are lying to us, or I should say those who are managing the computer models and selecting what data sets are inputted are lying. Here's another example. The medieval warming period is another point of embarrassment. And the climate research unit at East Anglia that I mentioned earlier, this is, like I said, along with the Our World in Data, which also manages most of the COVID data as well, that is inputted to NGOs and governments around the world to make policy. It's very centralized. And people have to realize just how centralized these things are that shape then mass perception of what is a consensus. What do the experts think? It's very controlled. The warming period was several hundred years during the medieval period where there were no SUVs, no industries, very low population, and yet it was significantly warmer than it was in our present age. The cooling period was a larger period from the Renaissance all the way to the beginning of the 19th century with a maximum period where there was no sunspot activity for 80 years around the time of Kepler and Galileo. where it was very, very cold. There's many documentaries written about this, but I just want to get this across, that this is very inconsistent with where does this medieval warming come from? If it wasn't the human CO2 production, what else was it?
Can I ask you one question? The warmer and colder period, we see this from, because there was no data collection as is today, so it must be from like historic reports or like images, like paintings or
you have historic reports. You have also ice cap sampling. You have trees. There's a variety of triangulated measures that scientists can take by looking at different things that nature gives us that has echoes or fossils, memories of the past temperature changes. There's things like sedimentary shells of little bugs or little crustaceans that just take into their calcium certain deposits of the different isotopes of oxygen and carbon and calcium that also give you an insight into the temperature levels and other variables in the world that they lived in before they died and settled to the bottom as sediment in oceans. There's so many different ways that these things are done. And again, there's problems with a lot of it. It's not a refined science, but it's good enough to make some pretty solid assessments. So one of the scandals at the East Anglia Institute is that Phil Jones, who I mentioned, who immediately after being punished, he was suspended for a few months and then completely absolved of everything and put back to work as a controller within months. Everyone was told to just forget about it. He was part with Michael Mann of creating these models that just try to erase the medieval warming period completely and then project. And Al Gore uses this in his famous documentary from 2005, mm-hmm. That just project this into a burning earth scenario of Armageddon and everybody is underwater, right? It's called the hockey stick chart. It has been completely disproven as a scientific fraud. But despite that, people still reproduce this and hum it. And it just ignores the observable realities of the medieval warming period and many other things. I know I'm running out of time here, so I've got a few more slides and then we'll just close it up here. But one of the other things that I found very persuasive is when you actually begin to look at the longer scale temperature and CO2 data, you do find that they do fit together. That is true. But, and it's always said, correlation is not causation. Though many people who say that, they still end up believing that CO2 causes temperature change. When you zero in on some of these larger scale, what we have above is a 600,000 year scale cycle, and below it you have a zoomed in period of 70,000 years from the present. And you see several, obviously, peaks and troughs. Which one is following which? If CO2 was causing temperature change, then you would always see the CO2 metrics moving, growing or decreasing before the temperature is increasing or decreasing. And in fact, what we do see instead is the opposite. You see that the peaks of temperature usually, not always, but usually peaking before, not after the CO2 peaks, meaning that the CO2 seems to be affected or shaped by the increasing or decreasing temperature changes, meaning that there's another variable that we're not looking at that's actually shaping the temperature changes of the Earth. Here's another example. Let's zoom in another way and look at the 140,000 year cycle. And we could just see here one or two solid examples of a 800 year lag between temperature change in blue and then the carbon dioxide ratios change in accordance, but with an 800 year lag. It's amazing. And then further on, we see in the other section there another lag of approximately probably a little bit more. So we're seeing, again, it's just not fitting the way they want it to fit. Here's another example that I've sort of already gone through of the global mean temperature anomaly, which, again, we've already sort of stated implicitly. And finally, this is the last slide of this type. The projections are all about how we are controlled through fear. If you can select your data, and I forgot to mention this, but Dr. Ilarionov, who is a Russian advisor formerly to Putin, no longer is the case, but in 2009 he still was, and he had made the point publicly that the Russians had given East Anglia Institute 476 data sets from 476 meteorological stations going back from 1865 to 2005. And he said it was scandalous. They ignored all but 121 of the stations, covering 20% of the Earth's surface area. They ignored all but 121. And amongst those, they selectively cherry-picked only the ones that they liked that corroborated the conclusions they wanted to have, making it seem as though the period of the 19th century was cooler than it actually was, and making it seem as though the period from 1965 to the present is warmer than it was. The fact is, we have been on the verge. From the 70s, people were thinking we were going into an ice age in 1977. It was a surprise that it got warmer. So looking now at the current trajectories of all of the data, of all of the models that they utilize, they're all making scare scenarios that the temperature is only going to keep rising. And that's why we need to reduce carbon dioxide to pre-industrial levels in order to keep temperature less than 1.5 degrees, they say. That's the whole point why we're modifying global behavior, right, under the COP26 thing or Great Reset. The fact is, if you look at it, again, we haven't really gotten that warm in the past 14, 15 years. It's not actually – and it's very much the same thing that they did for COVID-19. They projected out all of these fear scenarios of what would we do if we don't lock down society. They're probably going to try to do this again soon. And what did they do? They just said, well, we're going to declare things that are flu cases. Typical flu has disappeared. We just call it all COVID-19 cases. All deaths, a variety of deaths are now being labeled COVID-19, and autopsies are not even being done in Quebec. They haven't been done since the beginning. So you can't even see if somebody actually did die of COVID-19 or not. So this brings us back to the question of, okay, well, where is this coming from? Who is shaping the Club of Rome that produced the limits to growth that justified this way of thinking about the future as an extrapolation of trends, of selected data sets to make people act in fear? So Alexander King is the founder of the Club of Rome. He said in his 1991 book, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, and famine and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself." And thus you get the actual sense of where they actually want the cancer to be carved out. It's humanity that they see as the problem. And the last slide I have, and then I'll stop. It's the very last slide. Yes, it is. This is... one of the co-founders of the Canadian Club of Rome, who worked very closely with Alexander King. He was the former head of the Privy Council Office, a controller of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau administration, a major technocrat. He worked very closely with Maurice Strong as well, who was co-founder of the World Economic Forum in 1972. At the same time that the World Economic Forum was coming online, Maurice Lamontagne is running as a senator of Canada. He's now managing an overhaul of the Canadian science policy practice. How do you fund science? How do you define what science is? How do you define its purpose? It radically changed everything. It was disgusting. And in his official reports, these are taxpayer-funded reports that one can read online, he says directly, "Nature imposes definite constraints on technology itself. And if man persists in ignoring them, the net effect of his action in the long run can be to reduce rather than to increase nature's potential as a provider of resources and habitable space." But then an obvious question arises, and this is it. This is the key. How can we stop man's creativeness? And this is really the thing. They recognize that when we are creative, when we make discoveries, we create imbalance. And a control freak yearns always for balance and deterministic predictability, right? That's the game master can always control that type of game. They can't control the effects of creativity or making life better for ourselves by building infrastructure or new scientific programs that uplift people and give them dignity. They hate that because then we tend to think more critically and we think more freely for ourselves. Next statement, he follows up on this by saying, okay, well, how can we proclaim a moratorium on technology? It is impossible to destroy existing knowledge, right? Here he gets a little sophisticated. It is impossible to paralyze man's inborn desire to learn, to invent, and to innovate. So he recognizes that this is fundamental. But what does he say next? In the final analysis, we find that technology is merely a tool created by man in pursuit of his infinite aspirations and is not the significant element invading the natural environment. So it's not technology itself that's the problem. It's something else that's invading the environment. It is material growth itself that is the source of the conflict between man and nature. And this is what gets us at the, I think, satanic, I'll just say it, element of this whole thing, that there is the idea that it is material growth itself. Human beings, every time we make life better, we have more people, then we cause nature to be in disequilibrium. That is what he says is the evil thing. And so he provides as a solution, turning our funding and investments of science, our infinite aspirations, towards things that reduce the intervention on nature. Investments in windmills, solar panels, what are called appropriate technologies that don't affect Africa because they don't change tribal cultures or anything like that. You build solar panels, all you need to have is an education level is the knowledge of a squeegee to like keep the thing from gathering too much sand in the Sahara. That's all you need. You can keep colonialism. You don't change nature that way. You don't build dams. You don't build anything that you know does that. So this is essentially what Carney is talking about creating a new green economy with new sets of values that put monetary incentives on reducing the carbon footprint, reducing the capacity to sustain life through those types of acceptable technologies. And bad technologies are ones that increase life, that increase abundance. Those are bad. Those are dirty. Don't allow that. So that was what I just wanted to end on. And I think the idea of, again, human nature and computer, don't think like a computer. And if you do think like a computer, you will always be susceptible to the arguments of people like Elon Musk or, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or other AI cultists who say that inevitably computers will replace human beings with AI, and you won't be able to prove them wrong.
So basically, the underlying idea of these eugenicists, because that's what is underlying all of this, I assume from what you're telling us, is that we need to slow the growth of population. We need to reduce the population because there's not enough of everything to go around for everyone. So let's make sure that we, the elite, have enough. That's what it is, right?
Well, yes. They're never going to be the ones to volunteer
this. Yeah, sure.
First on the chopping block. Hmm?
But yeah, but that's what it boils down to, I think.
I think you're right.
It's extremely simplistic. And once again, just as we've learned from COVID, thanks to COVID, really, we have to take a close look at the facts. We have to not just be satisfied with the facts that they serve us on a silver platter, but we have to ask questions. We have to get behind the veil that they have created, because only then can we understand what is true and what is not true.
Exactly. And looking for the causal principles and things in human systems, the causal principle is in ideas and intentions. That's the metaphysical causal principle, that it's the motive force of all human history, good ideas, bad ideas, and their effects that are measurable. But you have to look with the mind's eye and not your eyes, because your physical eyes can't see that sort of thing. And in nature, you have to look at things like cosmic radiation. You have to look at what is the sun doing? What's the processes inside of the sun that we haven't even discovered, and how is that being affected by the galaxy, right? There's all sorts of things that we've only begun scratching the surface that are much more related to the cause of why we go into ice ages, why the temperature goes up or down, than anything that CO2 has anything to do with. So we have to make those types of discoveries. And if people like Max Planck or Einstein or Dmitry Mendeleev thought the way modern scientists are being trained to think in the modern education system and just obey what, you know, a consensus opinion is about a standard theory of this or that, they would never have made the discoveries that they made. Right. They couldn't have done it that way. Yeah. So we have to get back to it.
You have to not accept what they're serving you. You have to think outside the box and then make up your own mind. That's what Lord Sumption has been saying all along. You don't have to be an expert on anything. You just have to use your brain, your head. But this is really what it boils down to. It's a very simple conclusion, very simple conclusion. And it's very anti-human.
Yeah.
I think You know, when I remember, like, back in I don't know, when did this Al Gore movie air? Like, that was
in 2004 or something.
So I saw that actually in a movie theater, and I was really flashed, and I thought, wow, Al Gore is speaking the truth. And, you know, because we heard about this, like, climate change thing before, and so it was like, I was really said, wow, that's amazing, you know, that he was so brave to say the word, basically. Yeah. But then, you know, afterwards, what's been striking me for a while is that I think it's, if you are really looking, if CO2 was the problem, then wouldn't you look at all the things that cause CO2 in the same way? Like, for instance, like, stop the military from bombing, like doing these exercise bombings, yeah, which brings a lot of CO2 into the air, or like stop the luxury, or like the you know, these cruise lines or whatever, like, might be a problem, like, of a larger scale. And I think it's not been looked at, like, you know, with the same, like, I'm biased, because what I think, what you always see is, like, the things they, I mean, what's suggested that we should do is always stuff that's on the small man, you know. It's basically us to, like, pull the belts tighter, to not take a car, to not fly, to, I mean, these things that are in our realm. But the other stuff, like the military, for instance, or like, when you show this thing of, like, you know, that they're pumping CO2 into the greenhouses. I mean, how is that possible that we're not supposed to drive a car when at the same time, you know, they're pumping out this CO2 in large scales? I assume it's just, like, very, you know, it's very unlogical that it would, you know, that you'd make this, if this was, like, the major, major problem, then you should take into account all these possible sources of CO2 pollution. You know, that's absolutely, has been bothering me for a while.
Absolutely. No, that's well said. And, you know, they are hypocritical. And if you look at people like Prince Bernhard and Prince Philip, the great nature lovers who founded the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, they had no problems shooting, you know, white rhinos in safari in Africa. They had no problem doing that at all. They didn't care about nature. They only saw it as a means to an end. And the end was the reinstatement of an imperial colonial policy that prevented the tribal people from developing and changing and keeping them in a little controlled cage, mm-hmm, right? That's always been the agenda. And, you know, another thing people always tell me is, they just say it all the time. It's, why are we spending money on fusion energy research or space exploration or things like that when we could be spending our money on ending hunger and ending poverty on the world? And it's like, well, we haven't been spending money. We stopped building nuclear power plants 40 years ago. That's the last one we built in Canada and the United States. We stopped our space program. We destroyed all of that for the past 40 plus years. And despite all of that, poverty's only increased, right? It's because there's an intention to keep people poor. It's not a question of putting money into Africa. It's the question of how is the money being used. And you've got IMF conditionalities and other things telling them they're not allowed to use it on dirty energy projects. They can't use their coal for their own development. And, you know, they have to now, as we're seeing, build windmills and solar panels as part of a Green New Deal globally to stay, you know, to have good behavior, which, again, it's totally colonial. It's racist. It's colonial. It's anti-human. It's hypocritical. Yeah.
And you know what I also find, or like, I mean, we have to also really be careful about, like, I mean, as the same thing what we see with the whole corona crisis, you know, when we have, like, a sort of not correct or, like, unevidence-based assumption in the foundation of whatever we are going to decide, you know, it's like it bears a lot of risks. In 2015, I took part in a conference, you know, it was like a geoengineering conference, because I was interested, like, with regards to, like, CO2, I mean, this global change management, this climate change management, if there was something that we could do. And it was like a 3-day conference, like, with a lot of profound scientists, you know, from all over the world. And they were, like, David Keith from Harvard. He was not there, but they were talking about his projects, you know, the idea of, like, putting into the air, I don't know, some kind of stuff, like, that would do some sort of solar radiation management, like, you know, in the same amount like what we saw from this volcano in Iceland. You know, put that into the air, so have a little bit of cooling effect. So they were discussing all these things. And they presented a lot of possibilities, like growing bamboo or something like that, fast-growing, you know, plants, and then bury them into the earth so that you'd have some, like, reduction of CO2. And but what I found interesting, I mean, the things that they provided or, like, presented as ideas, they were really very intense, like, you know, actions with regard to the climate. I mean, like this idea of David Keith putting up, you know, bringing out into the air all these particles that then make problems themselves, you know. And they were talking about the white skies of geoengineering. If you put all that stuff into the air, then you have, you know, like, I mean, the sunlight doesn't come through in the same way. Then maybe you have problems with water vapor, you know, not dissipating so quickly or whatever. I mean, like, all these things that are so intense and so technology driven and, like, so big in scale, you know, it's really very dangerous. And if the foundation, you know, the basic assumption is wrong, I mean, what kind of harm can you cause on Earth? And I think that that's the same, I mean, or similar, this thing, you know, we see, okay, it's not an Ebola virus that we're looking at, but we're doing all these things on a large scale that are maybe have no effect or are harmful, and we're destroying so many other things. So we have to look at all these things very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's all about the effect, because like I went through with the global warming issue, the entire mythology, the entire system was built around getting the effect of reducing CO2, which was to reduce human population, right? The cure was the disease, in fact, because the disease was never actually a disease.
Exactly.
And so it's the same thing for coronavirus too, I think. When you look at it, the effect, it's the cure that is the problem. That's always been what they wanted at the end of the day. It was never, we're afraid of things we shouldn't be afraid of, and we're not afraid of things that we should be a little bit more afraid of. That's how our priorities have been all turned inside out. But I think when it comes to making big changes in nature, I'm not a fan of the Bill Gates or, you know, idea of spreading particles to block out the sun. But, you know, like, geoengineering is an important thing, but it comes with the important condition that you have to have real knowledge of the principles of the biosphere in mind. You have to earn it before you make a change. If you make a big change with ignorance, you can do a lot of damage. So you don't want to do the changes the way we've been doing big biospheric changes for the past, you know, 50 or so years of clear cutting rainforests or whatever. But, you know, if you have a sense of, I think, real processes, you have a real knowledge that you've earned, and then you can start testing things like what Gaddafi was doing for greening the Sahara Desert under Libya. That's a good example of just, you know, let's take some of that underground water that used to be above ground. Let's start systematically moving it above ground, creating more green areas before NATO bombed them back to the Stone Age, you know. China's doing it as well with the Gobi Desert. They got a big 50-year project right now to do a lot of big greening. And we'd learn a lot along the way. And maybe in doing so, we could start experimenting with, you know, 100-year, very long-term projects for terraforming other planets, maybe with the lessons we learn in our own backyard first. But you got to start somewhere. You got to sort of have a method of building real knowledge and not let computers think for you and lose your power of human creative reason. You know,
which brings us back to ideas. Humans have ideas. And the other side seems to want us to stop having ideas. It's very, very obvious. If it's true that it's all about the effect, and I think it is true, then upon closer inspection, you find that both with this climate scare and with COVID, the problem was created by them first in order to produce a solution which has the desired effect. I mean, it's very easy to see through this. If you look at the idea that I think that's part of the Great Reset, that in 2030, no one will own anything and everyone will be happy. But the obvious question that everyone should ask is, who owns it then if we don't own anything? And there you have it. I mean, it's all about the effect. They're going to own it. They're the ones who are killing us. They're the ones who are destroying our economies. And they're the ones who are going to own everything. So those are the easy answers, to me at least.
Yeah, no, you could always dig into it more. But yeah, there's simple, elegant answers. And at the end of the day, you could also see why it is insane and absurd. Like, why are they wrong? Try to do a thought experiment and prove why they're wrong, you know? And I think reading things like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World is a useful thought experiment. Just read it. Read the dialogue between Mustafa Mond and John Savage, because they're using these things as a guideline, a blueprint to navigate through their own grand designs for society, because this is something which is, you know, it's transgenerational. There's a broader continuity. So how does it cohere and maintain itself? And I got to tell you, one of the things that I've noticed is that the caliber of thinking, when you look at the new generation of oligarchs, and I include Klaus Schwab in this too, who's a student of Henry Kissinger, look at the quality of thinking that they exhibit in their writings and their words. And you compare it to people like H.G. Wells or Aldous Huxley or Julian Huxley or Bertrand Russell, like the old generation, they were much higher quality thinkers. And they're getting soft mentally in their own decadence and their own surety of having been for generations on the top of the food chain. You know, there's a stupidification happening as well. And I think that's a great reason, one of many proofs to know that the system that they are operating under, this social Darwinian system of might makes right, and you have the alphas, and then you got everybody else, you know, of the slave caste below. They dumb themselves down. They breed within their own little shallow gene pools, right? The queen was married to her cousin. You know, this is weird. It's actually unscientific. So they're actually disobeying the laws of nature that are discoverable, because they're so committed to their cultural prejudices that they were born into and that they're cultivated with. And it's tragic and it's sad and it's gross and it's wrong, but it's part of life.
And it's what's going to help us. I mean, inbreeding has never been a good idea, you know. We're seeing the results of this right now.
I mean, if these the graphs that we see, the Ferguson graph and these climate graphs that you showed, I mean, they seem to be pretty related. So it's that if that's the, you know, the result of if that's the best science they can do, I'm not quite sure if that makes sense.
Yeah. No. And if you look at really good scientists, like there's wonderful people out there like Heinrich Spensmark, who's a Danish scientist who's done remarkable work on cosmic radiation as far as a causal driver for cloud formation, which is such a simple connection to temperature changes, which is tied to the electromagnetic field of the Earth and the sun's electromagnetic field, which pulses. And when the sun's electromagnetic field is stronger, you know, when you have these 11-year cycles of minimum maximum solar activity, that stronger field absorbs most of the planets in our solar system, which keeps out intergalactic cosmic rays from coming into the inner regions of the solar system. And when the sun loses that power, the cosmic rays just penetrate deeper into our system, and then they come in through the aurora borealis, right through the Van Allen belts, and they seed clouds, clouds drive temperature. You know, if you want to know why we're going to go into an ice age soon, you got to look at cosmic radiation. It's not global warming, which we should be concerned about. All of the astroclimatologists that are worth anything right now are all warning that we're on the verge of a Maunder minimum, or maybe even a bigger ice age, because we are ultimately sort of in an ice age. It's just been a little lucky 12,000-year period of a little warming blip. But by all intents and purposes, we're scheduled to go back into a deep cool for a long time. So there's ways that the human mind can cultivate, you know, quality ideas that could allow us to circumvent the type of death that would normally occur to most things in nature. Mm-hmm. But we're all looking at the wrong things right now, and you know, we're looking in the
wrong direction. Yeah, quite obviously.
That's true.
Once again, this is a sleight of hand game that's being played on us. Okay. Well, Matthew, thank you for getting up so early for us. But I think our viewers will be very happy with what they've heard, because it opens up our eyes and minds and makes us look at what we're being presented with from a different viewpoint. It enables us to, you know, ask the right questions and look beyond what they're presenting to us, look through this through all this misinformation, propaganda, etc. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much. Okay, we'll be in touch. There'll be more opportunities for us to talk.
Great.
Okay. Take care and have a great weekend.
You too.
Bye, guys. Thank you. Bye-bye.